Engaging conversation on the most urgent problem of our day and what you can do about it.
Now, the End Abortion Podcast by Priests for Life.
Hello, friends. Father Frank Pavone here, National Director of Priests for Life. Welcome to our program. Welcome to another episode in this series where we are examining the Friend of the Court briefs that have been submitted to the Supreme Court in this case of Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, a key abortion case that the court is now considering. As we've explained to you over multiple programs, the court is answering the question as to whether all pre-viability bans on abortion are unconstitutional. It's a key question. It goes to the core of what is asserted both in Roe v. Wade and in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, where this really artificial line is drawn for the states. And they are told that they cannot, in fact, protect babies in the womb if they are earlier in their development than what is viability. And as we've explained on various other episodes, what that line is, well, it's not so much a boundary line, viability, as it is a prediction that is based on many different variables. So it's not a solid boundary either by medical standards, and it's certainly nowhere in constitutional standards. So we're going to continue looking at the different kinds of arguments that are being presented to the court by various leaders and organizations and other interested parties. Well, today we have a very esteemed colleague. In fact, he's one of the leading defenders in our country of religious freedom through Liberty Counsel, of which he is the founder and chairman. He's been a strong ally and great friend over the years, collaborator in many different ways, and really one of the most highly respected legal experts in the country when it comes to these constitutional matters related to our Judeo-Christian values, which he defends in so many ways. Liberty Counsel does this. We're talking about Matt Staver, who has not only a legal background and has authored hundreds of legal opinions in numerous books and has argued before numerous courts, including the Supreme Court, but who is also a pastor and has done pastoral work not only before going to law school, but also in his current work as well. So Matt, welcome to the program. You bring to these issues such a fantastic and rich background, and it really is a joy to be an ally with you in these important causes.
Well, thank you, Father Pavone, and it's certainly an honor and a privilege to be an ally with you in this very critical issue of life. In fact, it is this issue that ultimately kind of added the component of the law to my pastoral background. When I was a pastor, there were two people in Kentucky, and the new documentary came out, 1983, called Assignment Life.
Oh, yes.
And the two individuals, one Roman Catholic, one Protestant, wanted to reach pastors and clergy. Yeah. And we were one of the first groups that they showed this to. And after watching that, I was really almost punched in the stomach because I didn't realize what was happening in my own community. And it was that moment that was a turning point that ultimately led me to immerse myself in this issue. And the very first case I read was going down to the University of Kentucky Law Library, where I checked out Roe versus Wade. As a non-attorney, it didn't make sense to me. It seems like they would not have granted this decision the way they did. But that ultimately propelled me to intersect law and our faith in the intersection of the law and the culture.
You know, I remember that video, and certainly that was, it was one of the pillars really of generating and growing the pro-life movement in America. So it's nice to recall that, and as you exemplify, it really did impact a lot of pastors and a lot of other citizens. And now, of course, we're at a moment where it seems, Matt, that the court could be ready to be making a significant change here. You know, I've noticed, let me ask you this, but just in a general way, then we're going to get into the specifics of the friend of the court brief that you've prepared and submitted to the court. But in general, I've been comparing in my mind how the Supreme Court has been dealing with the whole question of religious liberty, on which, of course, you're one of the foremost experts, with the way that it's dealing with abortion. And what I mean is this. Take, for example, that precedent called the Lemon case, which has been, you know, people may not know it by name, but, you know, this whole question of, we can't have this cross on public property. It's an entanglement of religion with the state, and we can't have that. And this stuff that for decades has been shaping our court decisions, with various decisions in recent years, as you well know, the court has changed the direction in a more friendly way to religious expression and the integration of religion in public life, as very much our founders understood it, and seems to be correcting the aberration of the last half century or so. And yet, if I understand correctly, you know, I've heard legal experts say, well, basically, you know, the Lemon test, as it's called, is out the window, but not necessarily by some explicit decree of the court saying we hereby overrule this decision. And it seems to me on abortion, and especially now with this case in front of us right now out of Mississippi, the Dobbs case, that the court has been really for some time now weakening Roe v. Wade, chipping away at it, turning away from it, and sometimes in not necessarily helpful ways. But nevertheless, now this case may give us an opportunity to see a serious a departure from Roe v. Wade, but it won't necessarily be, you know, we hereby reverse Roe v. Wade. Am I on the right track with that analysis?
Well, I think yes. What we have seen is a good trend on religious liberty overturning or moving away from, you know, the past half century of some very bad decisions that have negatively impacted our culture. We're seeing somewhat of that, but sometimes it's two steps forward and one step backwards. For example, we had a decision that Roberts was the swing vote on a couple of years ago with regards to clinic regulations, and we thought it was going to go be upheld, and unfortunately it was struck down. It should have been upheld. But now we have this case, and this case could be a huge chipping away at Roe versus Wade. It could ultimately be the demise of Roe versus Wade. I believe either way, during our lifetimes, we will see the overturning of Roe versus Wade in America. But this case could be a huge step in that direction, or it could actually be the overturning of Roe. If you go back to 1992, you don't have to directly challenge Roe to overturn it. In fact, the 1992 Casey decision, the original vote was 5-4 to overturn Roe versus Wade. And that was regarding various kinds of informed consent, some other kinds of regulations, but it wasn't a direct challenge to Roe versus Wade. And yet that was the original vote, and that's how it was being written for the first 30 days. And O'Connor and Souter, they were in the dissenting at that point. They continued to pressure and try to convince Kennedy to change his vote. He did, and the next 30 days, that decision was taken away from Rehnquist, and it then modified but upheld Roe versus Wade in June of 1992. So we could have actually overturned it then, but for one vote, but for two people that tried to bring, and they did successfully, Kennedy to their side, and therefore 5-4 upheld Roe versus Wade. But this case here, here's the interesting thing about this case. This case is a pre-viability case. Whether or not you can regulate or prohibit abortion prior to the baby being able to live outside the womb with current medical technology. under the Supreme Court precedent for decades, the answer to that question has been from the Supreme Court, no, you can't do that. You can only do it at the point of viability, where it's able to live outside the mother's womb, in the late, now second trimester. So this lower court followed the Supreme Court precedent, struck the law down. The Court of Appeals followed the Supreme Court precedent, reluctantly criticizing the precedent, and even so stating that Roe versus Wade needs to be reconsidered, but felt that it had no choice but to strike the law down based upon, you know, nearly 40 years of Supreme Court precedent. So you would think, why would the Supreme Court get involved in a case like that that actually followed its precedent? And the actual question presented that the Supreme Court took is very odd. And it says this, you know, under this, essentially, I'll paraphrase it, under the 4+ decades of Supreme Court precedent, stating that you cannot ban abortion prior to viability, did the lower courts err in upholding a law that bans abortion prior to viability? In other words, did the lower courts err by following and applying the 4+ decades of Supreme Court precedent? The answer should be, if you're the Supreme Court, no, because they followed what we said.
Right.
But because they took that case, that means that they are not having a problem with what the lower courts did. They're going to reexamine what the Supreme Court has done for the past 40 years. And that's why something's going to happen. And it could be very significant. You need 4 justices to take a case. You need 5 justices or a majority to actually win a case.
Right.
But in a case like this, we know from other comments that the justices have made in other cases, that in cases of this magnitude, even if you have 4 justices to take a case, sometimes those justices decide not to. Why? Because they cannot reasonably predict that they'll get a 5th vote. And since they can't reasonably predict a 5th vote, they don't want to cause more problems than they would ultimately otherwise have if they didn't take the case. They'll wait for another time when they could rely on the 5th vote. So I believe you obviously have 4 justices here that are interested in taking the case. But beyond that, I think the 4 justices are counting a 5th justice, maybe was part of that decision, or maybe could reasonably be counted upon to rule with them and have a majority against Roe v. Wade.
And it took them quite a while to decide, didn't it? I mean, they were considering taking it for an unusually long period of time, weren't they?
Yeah. And I think in doing so, what they were doing is they were making those calculations that I just talked about. Do we reliably have a potential 5th justice? Or did that 5th justice actually join them in agreeing to take the case? But if they could not predict a 5th justice, I will almost certainly guarantee you that the 4 justices would not have agreed to take the case. What they would have done is file some kind of an opinion that Roe versus Wade needs to be overturned, reexamined, etc. But they would not have voted to take the case because they would not want to make things worse as they're trying to bring the court back more in line with the Constitution.
Matt, as you know, and for those that are just joining us, we're talking with Matt Staver, who is founder and chairman of Liberty Council, and one of the foremost defenders of religious liberty in our country. Matt, as you know, in 2019, Justice Clarence Thomas issued a strong opinion. It was a concurring opinion on a matter of coming out of Indiana, Box versus Planned Parenthood. They were asking the court to for cert to hear a case, and one of the laws at issue in out of Indiana had to do with prohibiting abortion if it was based on discriminatory motives. And we've seen these kinds of laws in various places. And Justice Thomas ended up giving, in his opinion, a history of the connection between abortion and eugenics. clinics. Yeah. And he raised a point, which you raise in this friend of the court brief. In fact, that it's a whole argument that you've developed here that I'd like you to explain, where he says, look, the state has a compelling interest to make sure that abortion is not used as a tool of modern eugenics. Yeah. And that is a very interesting point, a very interesting, compelling interest that the states do have. And you have made it into an argument in this brief, a saying that abortion has its roots in eugenics. It is rooted in racism, and that this is one of the reasons that the court should not reaffirm Roe v. Wade, because it should not reaffirm a collaboration with a racist eugenics movement. Tell us about how you developed this argument.
Yeah, well, this brief that we filed, it is representing a coalition, a broad-based coalition of African-Americans, Hispanics, Roman Catholics, and Protestants on this very issue. And let's begin by just kind of looking at the history of this. Let's begin with Charles Darwin. In his book, The Origin of Species, is what we typically end with that. But the full title of it is The Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection or the Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. Now, in a subsequent book, The Descent of Man, Darwin described certain kinds of people that were not worthy to continue to live as humans on this earth. Australians, Mongolians, Africans, Indians, South Americans, Polynesians, and even Eskimos he called savages. It becomes very clear that certain people and certain European individuals were lesser human beings in his view. He said that because of his evolutionary idea, that some of these individuals were more akin to apes and as low as a baboon, and that they were pulling down the human race. This Darwinian theory permeated many of American public life, including the Supreme Court in 1927 in the case of Buck versus Bell. Social Darwinists believe that in order to evolve a better human race, you need to eliminate certain populations. And some of those were based upon race, like African Americans, Hispanics, other people, and certain Europeans that were from not the northern part of Europe, but for some of the southern parts of Europe. Those weren't worthy to exist. And so what happened in the United States, in addition to people with disabilities, those that had epilepsy and those that were considered, quote, low IQ, they wanted to eliminate those populations. And so what they did was they quarantined them against their will in homes so they could not procreate. They kept them in these sanitariums until they were beyond childbearing age, and then they would release them. But obviously, that's very expensive, takes a long time. So in order to speed up the process, they wanted to sterilize them. And a test case ultimately developed in Virginia, Carrie Buck. She was in the Lynchburg, Virginia area, near where Liberty University currently is. And she was someone that they considered, quote, low IQ. Their testing was very flawed. And she had a baby that they considered low IQ, which there's no way that they would have known. And they said that her mother was low IQ. So they ultimately passed a law in Virginia to take Carrie Buck and those like her, where they wanted to eliminate their ability to procreate. Mm. The case went to the United States Supreme Court, 1927. And Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. wrote the opinion. His father and himself were social Darwinianists. His father taught at Harvard Medical School. They believed in Darwinian evolution, and they wanted to evolve a better human race. Sounds familiar, like some people we know, Adolf Hitler. And then obviously it comes to Margaret Sanger. So in 1927, the decision was released and they upheld the law. Carrie Buck did not want to be sterilized. The law said that the state had the authority to sterilize her, and the law was upheld. And the infamous phrase came out of that, quote, three generations of imbeciles are enough, close quote. In other words, the state has put up with enough of you people. So we're going to stop you from procreating and eliminate your your history here on this earth. And so that then spread to about 20 some states that passed similar laws. And it caught the attention of Adolf Hitler and others. Hitler then did the same thing for his camps in Nazi Germany and elsewhere. And then Buck versus Bell, the Nazis cited it in their defense in the Nuremberg trials to say, look, you Americans did this. We just supercharged it. So what's your problem with us?
Right.
Well, Planned Parenthood, Margaret Sanger, idolized Darwin. And so she began to set up these contraceptive clinics. And by the way, I would say that the Roman Catholics have gotten that issue right, and Protestants have gotten that issue wrong on contraception. And the Protestants and the Protestant denominations need to learn from Roman Catholic history and doctrine and teaching on this issue, because this has been the precursor to abortion, and this is a different way to stop procreation. So here's what Margaret Sanger did. She had these contraceptive clinics, and she set them up intentionally in minority neighborhoods. Why? To eliminate the procreation of those, quote, undesirable races. She intentionally wanted to target and eliminate the Black population. She enlisted the help of Black pastors and clergy to promote this. She gave a talk at the KKK event, and she said in her own words that birth control means the release and cultivation of the better revival elements of our society and the gradual suppression, elimination, and eventual extirpation of defective stocks. And some of those stocks were people of color. And so that's where it began. She ultimately said in a letter to Clarence Gable in 1939, quote, we do not want word to go out that we want to exterminate the Negro population, and the minister is the man who can strengthen, straighten out that idea if it ever occurs to any of their more rebellious members. So she was soliciting the help of clergy, Black clergy, to promote the idea of contraception for the Black community, knowing that the purpose was to eliminate the population, but she knew if that got out, her movement would ultimately be hurt. So she wanted to basically put false spin on it. And so now to this day, after abortion in the 1973 decision, Planned Parenthood added abortion clinics. And now if you look, Planned Parenthood commits 40% of its abortions. It produces 40% of abortions in the United States, and it estimates that it kills, Planned Parenthood abortion clinics alone kills 247 Black babies every single day.
It's amazing. And you point out in the brief too, this statistic that some 8 in 10 Planned Parenthood clinics are within walking distance of minority neighborhoods, Black and Hispanic as well, which makes it so appropriate, as you were mentioning at the outset, the coalition here that is submitting this brief, right? There's, I notice our friend and colleague Alveda King as one of the principal members behind this brief. Also another friend and colleague of mine, Deacon Keith Fournier, and the Diocese of Tyler, which many of our viewers know is headed by Bishop Joseph Strickland, who has been such a strong voice on these matters. And then Matt, you're also involved with the Evangelical Hispanic National Hispanic Christian Leadership Conference.
Right.
I noticed there too. This is a great coalition of people.
And the Frederick Douglass Foundation.
Frederick Douglass, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I mean, this is a beautiful coalition. And it's such a strong argument. I remember Clarence Thomas also saying, hey, look, you know, Margaret Sanger saw birth control as a way of, you know, controlling population, reducing undesirable people. And then when abortion is legalized, when you think about it, he said, this is an even more powerful tool because you're not just keeping people from reproducing, you're keeping them from being born altogether.
Right, right.
And
you really start off, and this is a three-phase movement. You start off incarcerating people so they can't procreate.
Right.
And that was too expensive. The next thing they did was they sterilized them. So the sterilization preventing them from procreation was that first level before medication, before surgical abortion. And it was first incarceration and then forced sterilization through some kind of surgery to sterilize them. Then you have contraception. The medications come online. And so now you give chemical medicines to stop procreation. And then after that, abortion comes online. And then you have people who may have been pregnant even with contraception or without it, either way. But now what you do is you kill the innocent child in the womb. And as Justice Thomas says, it's even worse. And it's eliminating a human race. And oftentimes what we see are these abortion clinics and the contraceptive clinics, they're intentionally put in these minority neighborhoods to increase the number of abortions of these minorities. In fact, the largest abortion clinic in the United States is a Planned Parenthood abortion clinic in Texas. Yes. And it is right positioned between a black neighborhood and a brown neighborhood. Wow. And across the highway is a school for young kids. And they position it there exactly why they wanted to do that, because it's a racist eugenic organization. It's been that way from the very beginning, to eliminate undesirable races. And that's her words. You know, her words are more children from the fit and less from the unfit. She says the chief aim of birth control, and now it also be abortion, is Superman. She says Superman is the aim of birth control. Superman. To evolve this superhuman race. That's what Adolf Hitler did. Adolf Hitler knew Margaret Sanger, liked her, supported her. Margaret Sanger was a supporter of Adolf Hitler. And it was all part of this eugenics movement. So here's what we are asking in this brief. Supreme Court, if you look at the history, you've had some very terrible decisions. Buck versus Bell, that was a eugenic, racist, a disability-based decision. It is reprehensible. To this day, it's never technically been overruled. It's not going to be enforceable, but it's never been technically overruled. Then you ultimately had the other cases, Roe versus Wade, and you then reaffirmed it with Planned Parenthood versus Casey. And look at the bloody history that you have created. You have sided with the worst racist ideology in world history to eliminate certain populations because certain people think that they're less favorable. And you need to, not only from a constitutional standpoint, overturn Roe versus Wade, but you need to distance yourself from this past racist history and bring it to an end once and for all. And if you do not, then Supreme Court, you are putting your stamp of approval. You are voting on the side of the worst racism in world history.
You know, it's a powerful argument, and particularly, it seems to me, in our climate now, when the left is using, just slapping the word racism on everything it disagrees with, of course, that cheapens the appreciation for really fighting authentic racism. But nevertheless, one can say, I mean, in this climate, shouldn't we all be all the more eager to stamp out racism where it actually exists? And I'm grateful for this coalition and this brief. And Matt, I'm grateful for your explaining it to us here today and explaining some of the overall context of this Dobbs case that really does give us confidence moving forward in this fight for life.
Yes, indeed, it really does. And, you know, if you look at some of this intentionality of Planned Parenthood, you've got, as you mentioned, 86% of its abortion facilities are in or near neighborhoods that are these neighborhoods predominantly that are minority population. The yes. 25 counties, there are 25 counties that have 86% of their abortion clinics. Those 25 counties contain 19% of the U.S. population of these minorities, including 28% of the black population and 37% of the Hispanic Latino population. So 86% are in 25 counties. Of those 25 counties, those 25 counties contain nearly a third of the Black population and more than a third of the Hispanic Latino population. And in 12 of those counties, Blacks and Hispanics and Latinos are more than 50% of the population. So it is very clear that what they have done is intentionally put these abortion clinics in these Black neighborhoods. And, you know, even Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the late Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she had this statement that was an awful shock, but it's really the reality of abortion. And she would be a vote on the wrong side if she were still on the court today. Yes. She said at the time of Roe, at the time Roe was decided, there was concern about population growth and particularly growth in populations that we don't want to have too many of. So that Roe was going to then be set up for Medicaid funding of abortion. There were certain populations, she said, we did not want to have too many of, and that was the reason for abortion. That's shocking.
Astonishing. It's astonishing. It really is. Matt, this is going to lead to a lot more discussions, of course, throughout our country and in our courts. Thank you for bringing this brief to the court and to our attention. And how can people get in touch with Liberty Counsel?
They can go to lc.org, lc.org, and they can actually get the brief there as well. We're going to be featuring it on the website, but lc.org is the place to go.
Fantastic. Well, I look forward to continuing to work with you in many different settings. Thank you, Matt, for all the work that you've done over the years that you continue to do with your team. And we look forward to speaking with you soon.
Thank you, Father Pavone. And thank you for all that you're doing and getting this word out.
Friends, I'm so grateful to Matt and his team, as I mentioned to him. And I want to let you know about one other resource, and I'd like to make this our recommended action for this episode. There's a documentary that a good friend and colleague of mine by the name of Mark Crutcher of Life Dynamics, based in Texas, created some years ago. And it's really caused a stir in the African-American community and beyond. It's called Maafa 21, M-A-A-F-A 21. Maafa is a Swahili term that means a great devastation. And 21 refers to the 21st century. What he says in this documentary is that abortion, this great devastation of the 21st century, is rooted beyond dispute in racism and eugenics. This documentary proves that point with overwhelming evidence. And that, of course, ties into the argument that Matt and his team, the coalition he put together, is making to the court. Please look up that documentary. I'm sure many of you are familiar with it already. Maafa21.com. Would you join me now in praying the Lord's Prayer for these intentions? For all your intentions, for all your needs, we'll pray for each other and for our great nation of America. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever and ever. Amen. God bless you, friends. Please connect with me on social media. Fr Frank Pavone is my address. You'll find me on Parler and Getter, on Twitter and Instagram and YouTube, Fr Frank Pavone. On Facebook, it's Father Frank Pavone. And connect with Right Side Broadcasting at RSB Network, at RSB Network. We want to stay connected with you. We keep praying for you. And please keep promoting this program so that we can have more and more patriots praying for America. Join you again tomorrow. God bless.
This has been the End Abortion Podcast. To learn more, to help end abortion, and to connect with us on social media, visit endabortion.net.